This is MSCI Perspectives, your source for insights for global investors and access to research and expertise from across the investment industry. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is September 5th, 2024. Now, a lot of you listening may be gearing up for Climate Week NYC. That event kicks off in a couple of weeks. MSCI will be playing its own part at the event through a series of presentations offering practical insights into the critical role of climate transition frameworks and scenarios in financial decision-making. And one of the key aspects of controlling or limiting climate change is the energy transition. That is, the global energy sector's shift from fossil-based systems of energy production and consumption, think like oil, natural gas, and coal, to renewable energy sources like wind and solar, as well as lithium-ion batteries. Now, today's episode of Perspectives focuses on the risks and the opportunities associated with that transition. And to add some energy to our discussion, please pardon the pun, I'll be speaking to a couple of our very own specialists from the MSCI ESG research team, as well as a portfolio manager from Cohen & Steers, whose ideas about the future of energy just might surprise you. So let's kick things off by jumping right into the heart of the matter. Just how well is the energy transition going?
Overall, I think you have to say that it's happening very slow.
That's our first guest.
I'm Chris Cody. I work on the ESG research team at MSCI. If you just look at the top level number for emissions, last year in 2023, emissions rose by just over 1%, 1.5%. And in the 10 years prior to that, just under 1% on average. So emissions are trending up. The consumption of oil is trending up. The consumption of gas is trending up. And the consumption even of coal is trending up, both in the short term over the last year and over the longer horizon. So it's hard to say that the energy transition is in full swing.
I asked Chris if he could go into just a bit more detail about the state of the climate transition.
In the short term, the signs of transition away from oil and gas, from oil demand, gas demand, they look like they're flagging a little bit. But these shifts have happened in the past at an exponential rate. And what that means is that risks can arise all of a sudden. So for this reason, it's important to understand the trends from the bottom up, industry by industry, and be scouting for leading indicators. But if you begin to look under the hood and look for drivers of transition, then a different picture emerges, where the general trend seems to be that emissions and consumption of the fossil fuels that drive emissions, they are largely decreasing in the developed markets, and they're increasing in the emerging markets. I would then think about what can drive emissions. What's actually changing to make any of this happen? And at a very high level, you could say that there's either increases in efficiency or there are substitutions happening where totally different processes are happening. Someone's driving an electric vehicle rather than using gasoline. Or someone is using sustainable aviation fuel in an aircraft rather than using just only jet caro, but they're blending some piece in, right? So these, I think, are the trends that we're looking for across industries to begin to understand what's happening fast and what's happening slow.
How does our second guest view the future of energy? Remember, I mentioned you may be in for a bit of a surprise here.
So we think from a starting point, the future of energy is a world where we need a lot more energy. As we think about what 2030 and 2040 hold, we think the global demands for energy are going to rise quite a bit between now and then. And so we've spent a lot of time the last few years thinking about what does the composition of energy markets look like. And I think one of our sort of key perspectives and takeaways is this notion of an energy transition is just a little bit sort of misunderstood or misrepresented.
That's
Tyler Rosenlicht. I'm a portfolio manager for global listed infrastructure strategies and the head of natural resource equities at Cohen & Steers. We think a lot of people hear energy transition and they assume we're going to be out with the old, in with the new. No more crude oil, no more natural gas, all wind and solar. And our reality is, you know, we're in this energy addition world. We'll see growth in wind, solar. We think nuclear will see a lot of growth as well. But it's not going to be sort of a repurposing of old assets all into new. It's going to be, you know, relying on traditional resources for a really long time and, you know, making sure that we can make the investments in new production and new supply to satisfy this, you know, huge growth in demand globally.
Can we get some numbers around that?
Using very rough numbers, today the global energy markets are about 190,000 terawatt hours. And I'd say it's really not important to think about what a terawatt hour is, but just 190,000 units of energy globally are consumed today. Right now, the world is about 85% traditional energy and 15% alternatives. In 2040, we believe global energy markets are going to be more like 215,000 or 220,000 terawatt hours. And in that sort of world, we actually think market share will shift from the 85-15 that I just talked about to being 70% traditional and 30% alternative. So as you look at sort of the composition of global energy, it will absolutely be more alternative than it is today. But again, a big thing is absolute increase in demand. And in 2040, we actually see more demand for natural gas and crude oil.
That's a pretty important prediction Tyler just made, that we'll see more demand for natural gas and crude oil going forward. But how did Tyler get to those numbers? I asked him if he could explain a bit more about Cohen and Steers' methodology.
A lot of people start on the supply side, where they kind of say, hey, we don't want temperatures to rise above X degrees, or we think this policy initiative is going to allow for this other outcome. And our view is, you know what? We actually think the best way to start is to start with trying to project demand. We can sort of worry about the composition of it later. And when you think about projecting energy demand, it's really just a three-function model. So the first is population growth. You know, all else equal, more people, more energy consumption. The second thing is economic growth. Again, all else equal, a bigger economy, more energy consumption. And the third one is a kind of tricky one, which is what we think about as the energy efficiency of the global economy. And it's basically, are we able to get more economic growth with the same or potentially less energy?
And that's 70-30 split?
So that 30 is a lot of different things. It definitely includes wind and solar, which we think are going to grow a lot. It includes hydropower, which we think is a great resource globally and places that can utilize it. We're big proponents of the continued growth in nuclear, for instance. And then it's all the sort of new technologies that are coming.
And for more on those technologies, let's check back in with Chris.
What we found through our recent research, starting with the technology side of things, is that there are not good options for large swaths of the economy that need to decarbonize. And by good options, we mean options that are economically attractive. So for power generation, I think it's no surprise that there are pretty good options here. Not perfect ones, but we've seen a large scale deployment of renewables over the last few years. This is happening around the world. It's happening in China. It's happening in the US. It's happening in Europe. Wind and solar penetration rates are increasing. And then I think more and more battery storage is also hitting the grid to solve the intermittency issue. When you do have good solutions like that, you see some movement much faster because the industry has an option to decarbonize. It's very simple. Where you see a lot less movement is when there are not good technology options. So in the transport sector, which is responsible for a lot of the greenhouse gas emissions entering the atmosphere every, you know, year or every day, you have gasoline, the combustion of gasoline, combustion of jet fuel for airplanes, combustion of diesel for trucking, and increasingly shipping, marine transportation as well. And so how do you decarbonize these? You have, for passenger vehicles, you have electric vehicles and hybrids as well. And these are pretty good options. For trucking and for marine transportation and for jet fuel, the options get a lot harder. The alternatives are more expensive. More infrastructure might be required to set things up, from, you know, grid charging to charging infrastructure to sustainable aviation fuel that's actually sustainable, meaning there's enough maybe advanced biofuel inputs to grow that industry to the level it would need to get to. And for marine transportation, I think just beginning to solve that problem. Green ammonia is on the horizon, but it's kind of farther out on the horizon than some of these other pieces. And so we're seeing, you know, emissions from transport grow every year in most parts of the economy, except for where EV penetration is highest. And then heavy industry is a whole other problem where you can electrify little bits. You can decarbonize through more expensive alternatives like low carbon feedstocks or, you know, using lower carbon hydrogen where possible. But a lot of these alternatives, they may be set up at a pilot scale, but there are very few examples of this happening.
To help us answer questions about electric vehicles in particular, I'd like to bring in our third guest for today.
My name is Yu Ishihara. I'm a executive director, MSCI's sustainable investment research team covering the automobiles industry.
Yu's latest paper, Auto Industry, Emissions versus Economics, takes on the question of the industry-wide challenges around the climate transition. His paper points out that the auto industry drives, yes, drives, about one-third of global demand for liquid fuels in particular. That makes it one of the most heavy-emitting industries in the world. Perhaps no surprises there, but Yu also talks about how the industry is at the forefront when it comes to transforming their business models for the climate transition.
I think it's completely fair to say that the automobile industry is at the forefront of transforming their business model. We're seeing nearly all the key stakeholders within the automobiles industry embrace, or even in some case, you know, enforce new alternative clean technology solutions, with obviously the poster boy technology being battery electric vehicles. And I say that because we're already seeing significant, and by significant, I mean around 20% or so of global car sales being electric vehicles in 2023. And this is obviously driven first and foremost by the car makers themselves, you know, not only by companies like Tesla or BYD that have emerged as major players into the market with a pure EV manufacturing business model, but also more of the incumbent companies like General Motors, BMW, Volkswagen or Hyundai, which have all committed to transition their product portfolios away from manufacturing purely combustion engine cars. But even thinking beyond the car makers themselves, the transition has also been supported by, you know, early adopter consumers who have been eager to get their hands on the new technologies, and even some of the early mass market buyers who, with the assistance from governments offering various forms of consumer incentives, possibly to alleviate purchase price concerns. So for sure, the automobile industry is definitely one of the leading industries in terms of transitioning away from fossil fuels. And a large part of that is not only due to the technological advances made by the car makers themselves, but also because there's been, you know, support from all the major stakeholders involved that, you know, helped to play a role in initiating and facilitating the industry's move away from fossil fuels.
So if the technology and the support are there, surely the auto industry can decarbonize overnight, right?
That's really the big question here. And it's, again, the main point of our research piece. You know, I think if it were just about decarbonization and just about swapping out combustion engine cars for cleaner technologies, the auto industry could, you know, potentially arguably complete its transition in the not too distant future. But the reality is obviously much more complicated. I mentioned several stakeholders and we have to think about their perspectives on all of this. So first off, you have to think about the consumer. Most consumers that purchase a car, you know, they do it as a daily necessity for transportation. So for that consumer, if an EV is not fit for purpose in the same way that a combustion engine car is, whether it's the driving range, you know, access to refueling or charging, and of course, affordability, you know, outside of those early adopters who can afford and want the latest and greatest technology, regardless of whatever limitations it may come with, most of the majority of buyers will definitely have to think twice about purchasing an EV. This then presents a problem for the actual car makers who need to convince consumers to buy their EVs so that they can decarbonize their business. But demand is now all of a sudden becoming a little less certain again because of weaker macroeconomic conditions. In addition, it's pretty widely understood by the market that, you know, quite simply, EVs are nowhere near as profitable as combustion engine vehicles. In fact, in, you know, fiscal 2023, Tesla and BYD were the notable pure-play EV car makers that were able to turn a positive operating profit per vehicle sold. But if we look at some of the other pure play EV manufacturers like Rivian, Lucid, or even NIO, they all managed an operating loss to the tune of $10,000 or even $100,000 per vehicle sold. Even Ford Motors, which has split its reporting into a combustion engine vehicle business and its electric vehicle business, you know, they reported nearly a $40,000 operating loss per vehicle sold in its EV department. So the point being, the tech opportunity, you know, which is arguably not perfected, but largely proven, but mass market consumers are probably still not convinced. Car makers are aggressively trying to transition their product offerings, and it's potentially costing them billions of dollars each year to do so.
So that's the big picture. But what about the story beyond EVs?
I think the first and, you know, foremost important thing to remember is that the goal from, you know, a climate change or decarbonization or net zero transition is to reduce vehicle-related CO2 emissions, and that the battery electric vehicles themselves just happen to be the most prominent technology available to us today to achieve that goal. But there's certainly, you know, alternative ways to reducing CO2 emissions available to car makers, including transition technologies like hybridization, or even things like vehicle lightweighting or making more fuel-efficient combustion engine cars. There's also alternative forms of electric vehicles, such as hydrogen fuel cells, or even alternative fuels as well. And all of this is important because not every car maker has opted to embrace, you know, battery EVs as the sole answer to the automobiles industry's decarbonization problems. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that not every car maker is racing to transform themselves into a pure EV player. And the reasons behind that are largely due to concerns that are not really related to decarbonization.
You also looked at this question from an investor perspective. After all, we are still talking about the hard work of figuring out how to deploy capital.
You know, investors that are assessing individual companies, we feel it will be important to understand the differences in the strategic choices that car makers are making, as it, you know, obviously has implications on the speed of their electrification and decarbonization, but also their fundamentals and profitability, which is obviously quite important to the investor. And I'm talking about things like, you know, understanding car makers' priority end markets, the government policies that are in place in those markets, the technological capabilities at their disposal, but also even things like the current financial standings. You know, these are all significant factors that car makers have to balance as they manage these trade-offs between emissions and economics. And this is certainly something that I think investors do need to focus on.
Given all that, and given the headwinds that you referred to earlier, I asked him the somewhat simple question of whether investors should still be investing in EV companies at all. And he, of course, gave me the not-so-simple answer.
I mean, I suppose it always depends, you know, on your investment time horizon. In theory, you know, one would hope that all car makers eventually reach pure EV or zero-emission fleets over the coming, you know, decade for the industry and for the world to basically achieve our climate goals. So in that sense, putting all your eggs into EV pure plays, or at the very least, you know, companies that are aggressively transitioning to become EV companies, could make sense if you're patient, or if you're convinced that combustion engine vehicles are just, you know, playing in a sunset industry. But I think investors would definitely need to weather a lot of volatility if that were the case. And what I mean by that is, again, we highlight this in the paper, is that for one, EVs are still part of the auto industry. And that also means that, you know, despite the fact that EVs are shiny and new and the great new technology, demand for them can be cyclical, and it's influenced by other macroeconomic or even geopolitical factors. And so for the car makers themselves, the technological switch can present some pretty significant trade-offs in the immediate term, which can impact a lot of different stakeholders, including shareholders, in the forms of, you know, dividends and fundamentals.
Keeping my investor hat on, I went back to Chris to see if there were any other sectors that he found that stood out in terms of getting this balance right between emissions and economics.
Well, Adam, I think, you know, at first it makes sense to point out that over the last 18 months, a couple of years, this has been a really hard time for key parts of the sort of energy transition economy from a total shareholder returns perspective. I think the valuations of these firms in retrospect were very high, right? There was a lot of hope and a lot of promise that they would deliver quickly from a financial point of view. And then reality hit. And I think we, broadly speaking, saw that there isn't a straight line upward to the right now. That's obvious for a lot of these industries. So wind got hit by supply chain issues. It got hit by changes in interest rates and growing inflation. And suddenly the economics for key projects didn't make the same sense that they did when these firms signed on to them. There were changing regulatory rules around, you know, electricity pricing in Europe, or the prospect for change. And I think that goes to show that regulatory uncertainty is going to continue to make valuation of these companies very difficult for some time. And conversely, the more regulatory certainty there is, the easier it will be. And same with falling technological costs, right? I think that a lot of this is a bet on when either governments will subsidize and to what degree governments will help subsidize and kind of help along some of these markets where there is still a green premium, so to speak, between kind of business as usual technologies and these lower carbon alternatives, or when the technology costs come down to a rate that erase that premium. And we've seen the technology costs come down so far. And then there's the question of implementation, right? That's the last piece of the puzzle. With implementation, I mean, we see in the US, it's just very hard to build anything, whether it's related to the energy transition or more generally, just large infrastructure is hard to build right now. And so on that front, you have, you know, delays to projects that seemed like sure things that are now delayed a quarter, a year, 2 years, canceled altogether, because there's no way to hook them up to the grid, or, you know, government support has moved, or people are, you know, concerned that it may move some months out in the future as, you know, things happen in the electoral world in the United States, for example. And I think this uncertainty will continue to contribute to volatile valuations across the broader energy transition complex, if you can call it that.
I had one more area I wanted to explore with Chris, namely, how easy or not easy is it for investors to play the energy transition?
Yeah, it's a great question and a very popular one right now. There's no easy industry filter or something to find the opportunity set that's potentially in play here. There's no energy transition industry in GICS yet, as far as I'm aware of, or any other similar classification system. These are really different types of companies operating in different types of industries and markets. I think a lot of this becomes a value chain question, which is really interesting but hard to disentangle. I think tracing these supply chains, understanding this is a major area of interest for investors in this space, definitely. That would be more on the pure opportunity side of accessing the areas of potential market growth in a non-obvious way. I mean, I think the whole other way of looking at this is to switch from focusing only on public markets where, you know, there is an opportunity set, but it may be more limited compared to the private market space, looking at unlisted companies that, again, are part of the supply chain, are part of the value chain, may not be as exposed to the volatility and short-term swings of the public markets just because of the slightly less liquid nature of those investments, and can peg their valuations to longer time horizons and suffer through what may be some of the growing pains of this market, but catch that potential long-term upward trend.
Earlier in the program, we heard Tyler's view on the future of energy. You may remember, he talked about a 70-30 split that was in favor of traditional sources of energy. I'd like to pick up that conversation with a question that I asked Tyler about whether that split, where fossil fuels continue to have such a prominent presence in our future, does that ease the pressure, so to speak, on these traditional energy companies to invest or to innovate toward alternative sources?
What I would say pretty forcefully is we think it's important for traditional energy companies to be honest about the long-term picture of traditional energy resources. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they should stay in place. You know, we think traditional energy companies might be some of the best opportunities for leadership in the energy transition. You know, I think it's kind of nuanced. Like I think some traditional energy companies will sort of miss it, get it wrong, and they will become dinosaurs over time. Others will, you know, rely on their traditional asset base and do really well. Others will make really smart investments in the transition and do even better potentially. And some will make, you know, probably pretty silly investments in the transition as well. So it's just not as black and white as are traditional companies good or bad for the environment, for their shareholders, for the global population. I think there's a lot of different outcomes on a company level. And you know, one of the exciting things for me as an active manager is trying to figure out who's going to get it right and who's going to get it wrong. We're trying to figure out what parts of the energy value chain across both the traditional landscape and the alternative landscape are going to be well positioned, not necessarily for next week or next quarter's earnings, but really for the next year and ideally the next 5 years.
Another point that Tyler raised earlier was the use of nuclear power, which is something of a controversial subject in many parts of the world. What I wanted to know was if investors were fully on board with the idea of nuclear.
It seems to me that they are. 2 or 3 years ago, I think nuclear was not a part of the solution that people appreciated or wanted. And the view was, hey, we don't need nuclear. We do think the sentiment's changing. And sort of the more conversations that I have with folks in the industry and sort of investment asset allocators and individual investors, I think there's a realization that, hey, nuclear can be a big part and should be a big part of sort of what the energy grid looks like going forward. And I think a big driver there is this understanding that one of the current challenges with other alternative resources is intermittency. When the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, solar and wind are awesome. But when those things aren't happening, you know, they're not generating power or generating electricity. And a lot of the demand growth that we see is sort of required to be on 24/7, 365, right? Like a data center. If I owned a data center company, the thing that would keep me up at night would be the data center losing power. And so I want to make sure that I have redundancy and backups and real high confidence that the power is going to come all day because I really need it. And again, that's one of the nice things about nuclear. Like once the facility is up and running and it's built to spec and it's built to sort of the standards that we can build nuclear at today. It's low variable cost, emission free, and it's baseload. It comes all the time. And that's a really important part of the future energy grid.
What about the impact of the regulatory environment from an investor point of view?
Yeah. So, I mean, a really big question or a really big consideration for government policymakers and so forth is what is our capability to extract natural resources or kind of generate our own energy domestically. So, you know, one thing that we've seen is, you know, places like Europe have spent a lot more money and policy initiatives on the transition and developing alternative resources. And to us, that's a reasonable thing because, you know, Europe does not have a lot of domestic natural gas and domestic crude oil. I mean, there's some in the North Sea and other places, but for the most part, you know, I would consider Europe an energy island. And that means that they're reliant on foreign partners to supply them with things like oil and natural gas. And obviously, we know what that did a few years ago when geopolitics really took a big change and a big turn. And so one of the nice things with wind and solar is, you know, everybody's got them to different degrees, but those are sort of natural resources that anyone can harness. And so I say all this because, you know, what you have or don't have, we think is a really important part of the policy docket. And places like Europe should and will continue to really invest a lot in alternatives because that should improve their geopolitical standing. You know, other places, I put the U.S. in the category, you know, we've got lots of low-cost traditional resources. And so our starting point from a geopolitical perspective is just a very different place. And so that's just a thing that folks need to keep in mind. What is your reliance on trade partners? What is your current grid? How stable is it? How redundant is it? And what does that mean in terms of where you should take it over time?
Now, the auto industry, used specialty, is no stranger to regulators and regulations. So let's hear from you again on the different types of roles that governments have played here.
So simply put, countries and regional governments have, you know, promoted EV share growth in their auto markets through various policy levers. You know, we can talk about things like consumer incentives, manufacturer incentives, penalties and restrictions on sales of combustion engine vehicles or fleet emissions, and even, you know, outright bans on sales of combustion engine vehicles. And the regions in the markets where the governments have been the most stringent in regulations, EV market share has been the highest. So, for example, you know, EV penetration in the overall broader EU market, which is around 20-some-odd%, and China, which is, you know, north of 30%, is well ahead of the global average, which is around 18% or so. And both markets have a history of implementing supportive regulations and policies. Conversely, for example, in the United States, less aggressive federal policies to reduce emissions may have contributed to a relatively slower uptake compared to these other larger car markets, as EV penetration's right around the 10% range. And this extends beyond just, you know, major passenger vehicle markets like the US, EU, and China. For example, in India, you know, the electric two-wheeler demand softened dramatically in the wake of incentive reductions. So again, this is being played out around the world across markets. And car makers, you know, they're obviously keenly aware that demand for EVs can be heavily influenced by the government's emphasis on, you know, broader decarbonization of economies through these policy supports for EVs. So again, from their perspective, relying too heavily on this policy support can also be viewed as a risk factor.
Another form of government support or intervention, depending on your point of view, is the use of tariffs. It's also a big conversation in many parts of the world across many industries today. In fact, over the summer, there were a lot of headlines made when the European Union imposed tariffs of up to 38% on Chinese EV makers. I asked you for his take.
I think these tariffs are actually, you know, just another example of how complicated the auto industry transition is, because again, there's so many stakeholders' interests at play here. So, because simply speaking from a purely a decarbonization standpoint, what these Chinese electric vehicles that are being, you know, imported into the EU are offering is the proliferation of lower-priced electric vehicles for mass market adoption. This, in theory, is exactly what we should want as a global society if we're just interested in reducing emissions. But for the EU, for example, you know, Chinese EVs that are being imported are a real competitive threat to incumbent car makers who, again, they're struggling to mass produce EVs profitably. So if these cheaper Chinese imports are able to meet the demands of local consumers, you know, the incumbent local automotive industry would certainly see a reduction in demand for their own electric vehicles, which would obviously be a big blow to the local automotive industry, which for some major EU countries is, you know, a significant source of their GDP and job creation. From the flip side, for China, these EV exports obviously present a huge opportunity for them to enter into the global marketplace, obviously for them to grow GDP, for them to grow their brands, for them to sort of gain market share historically where Chinese, you know, car companies historically have not been part of the global market. But obviously, in the face of these very high tariffs, they're facing a situation where clearly they're trying to offer something which may help the global cause for decarbonization, but for lack of a better term, geopolitics is getting in the way, which obviously is going to have ramifications for maybe other industries. So ultimately, these tariffs, they're kind of in direct opposition for different nations' sort of, you know, decarbonization ambitions. They're also there because they're a protective measure for their own economies and labor markets. And this is just another way of illustrating that same point I was making earlier about car makers, but, you know, governments and all these other stakeholders, the auto industry transition is unfortunately much more complicated than just replacing, you know, a combustion engine with an electric vehicle.
That last point on geopolitics provides a nice segue back to hear from Tyler one more time. Here's what he had to say when I asked him what sort of impact it could have on the energy transition as a whole.
The really tricky question, because I think it is speeding up. I mean, we're seeing sort of more desire and a speeding up of the desire to make the grid cleaner and reduce emissions and get to meet net zero. But it's obviously coming with the tension of, do I have a reliable local domestic energy economy or not? And so, you know, if we see more global peace, I think that that would make it a lot easier to speed up the transition and sort of get us to a net zero world. If we see a lot more fragmentation in geopolitics globally, and it's going to become a lot more about friendshoring, you know, relying on specific trade partners, you know, maybe not making investments in parts of the alternative value chain because you need to redirect that into LNG import terminals or something like that, that might slow it down. So again, we're very confident we're going to go into this place where we do eventually, over the long run, reach net zero. The question's kind of the path and the speed with which we get there.
That's all for this week. Our thanks to Chris and you from MSCI ESG Research, and Tyler from Cohen & Steers, and of course to all of you for listening. And last but not least, thanks to our new co-producer, Manish Mandavia, for putting this episode together. Remember, you can find Yu's paper, Auto Industry, Emissions versus Economics, on the Research and Insights section of MSCI.com. Next up on the program, it's been difficult to miss the articles about delirious debt and distress in real estate. We'll work on sussing out the signal from the noise, as they say. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.